When an offender is released from prison, they face a lot of challenges on the outside. Where will they live? Who will hire them? How will they stay clean? I'm Annie Feit. All this week, Alaska Public Media is examining prisoner reentry with the series Hitting Reset. And it's our topic today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Alaska Department of Education is looking for 3 experienced Alaskan educators to help underperforming schools improve instruction and student performance. These school improvement coaches would work as contractors to the state. Apply by September 15th. Call 907-465-8721 or inquire at the Department of Education for information. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Education. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
In Alaska, 1,000 people leave prison and re-enter the community each month. That's a statistic you're going to hear a lot on Alaska Public Media this week as we air our series Hitting Reset. By the time 3 years is up, more than half of those offenders will have gone back to prison at least once. But a lot of different entities are working to help prisoners successfully transition to life back in the community. Here to discuss that transition is Ann Hillman, KSKA Urban Affairs reporter, who produced the series and will lead a television forum on the topic later this week. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. And Morgan Jaco is a reentry coordinator with the State Department of Corrections. She's a probation officer who knows the transition from prison to community inside and out.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And we want to hear from you. Do you have a personal story about yourself, a family member, or friend who's working to make a new life outside of prison? Do you have insight into what it would take to make the process more successful? Give us a call. 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, please dial 550-8422. And of course, you can email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And Anne, let's start with you. Where did this idea for the series come from?
You know, I was doing a lot of things on housing. I do a lot of stories on housing and things like that. And so I wanted to know about our new voucher program that Alaska Finance Housing Corporation had to give vouchers to people who are leaving prison. And so they were like, oh, we'll go down to Partners Reentry Center and they can talk about housing. So I go down there with the anticipation of, you know, setting a couple interviews. And I come back with this whole idea for a series because re-entering the community after leaving prison is a whole different experience from what most people know. The only thing I can make it akin to is coming back into the community when you've been abroad for a while. And so I talked to them and I was like, all right, series forum, let's do this.
Okay, and yeah, tell us about the forum on Thursday.
So Thursday evening here at the KSKA KAKM studios, we're going to be filming a live forum with a panel of experts. So folks from DOC, folks who have developed the recidivism plans, re-entrants who have come back into the community after prison, talking about what that experience is like and how we as a community can make it easier for everyone, because these are community members. We interact with people who have been in prison every single day. So the forum is going to be taped at 7 p.m. here at the Public Broadcasting Studios. We'd love for people to be here at 6:30. It's not just a forum. It's also an art show with portraits called Showing All Faces, with this idea that you don't know who has a criminal history and it shouldn't matter. So portraits and art and discussions. And we'd also like people to give questions. So if you don't get to call in during TOA, if you want to ask the deputy commissioner of DOC questions directly about reentering, we'd love for you to submit them online. You can email me at ahillman@alaskapublic.org. This is a chance for a community conversation.
And do people need tickets?
No.
Okay, just show up.
Show up, have a sandwich, watch some art, and then contribute to the conversation.
Okay, and to start things off on the show, I want to play the first piece in the series, which is about April Wilson, a woman who was released from Highland Mountain Correctional Center last month. Can you set up the story for us?
So I first met April. There's a program at Highland called Success Inside and Out. And it's this like day-long conference and people learn about skills they need on the outside. So I met April there and she's like, yeah, you can follow me around from my first day. I was like, what a great experience. So when we joined this, I had just gotten to Highland. I went with her mentor. Her mentor's name is Joan. And this is her first day out.
Let's blow this joint.
She's ready for the world, except that she doesn't have a jacket, just a thin hoodie, and it's about 15 degrees out. The person picking her up is Joan Miller, April's mentor. They met through a faith-based therapeutic program in Highland called the Transformational Living Community, or TLC. It's focused on overcoming addictions. They've known each other for about a year.
I don't know if you need an extra fleece. You want to wear this?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, I'll let you hold that. And here's a scarf.
Thank you. Thank you, Joan.
As we drive toward Anchorage, Wilson borrows my phone to call her 18-year-old daughter. Within minutes of hanging up, her mother is on the line.
That's crazy. My mom is calling already. Chanel probably said, Mom's out of jail.
Until recently, April hadn't talked much to her mom. They hadn't seen each other in years. For about 15 years, April was in and out of prison on theft charges. She was stealing to buy cocaine. A couple of weeks before she was released, we sat in the correctional center cafeteria, and she told me about her past. She remembers the first time she got out of prison, years ago.
The first time I got out, I had people sending me money and giving me money here, so I saved that money, and I went and got high. That's what I did.
April says prison became a revolving door. She didn't try to get clean until this nearly three-year-long stint. After deciding to join the Christian therapy program, she called her mother.
She just basically told me she was tired of me. When was I going to get myself together? I have a daughter. How do I think it makes her feel with her mom always being in jail?
She'd heard it all before, but this time it sunk in. April decided to commit herself to TLC, and things changed.
Now my daughter even tells me she loves me. She can't wait until I get out. And she also said, Mom, I see something very different in you. So it makes me very proud.
That hope and enthusiasm are still with her as she sits down for her first meal out, breakfast at Denny's.
I want two poached eggs, English muffin, two strips of bacon, and hash browns.
In prison, she ate rubbery pancakes and boiled eggs. The waitress sets down the plate.
It looks amazing. Yeah. Way different. Yeah. I'm gonna be stuffing my face now.
By the end of the meal, the excitement begins to wear off and April's nerves kick in. We swing by a store to buy Tums before heading to the parole office in the DMV. She's required to check in with her parole officer within 24 hours of release, and it's hard to do things without an ID card. It's all relatively quick. By 10 a.m., we're at the mall, trying to get a reduced-cost Lifeline phone. That's when April hits her first stumbling block. She doesn't have the right paperwork with her to qualify for the cheaper phone. And after giving the friend she's staying with $100 to help pay for rent, she has just over $100 left to get by on until she gets a job.
So people just getting out of jail, you guys don't do Lifelines just for that?
No. That doesn't qualify for Lifeline.
Oh my God, if I buy one of these phones, that's going to take almost all my money gone.
Well,
I don't have a choice but to do it. I need to get a phone.
Well, can't you use Sheva's phone just for
No, because she's on a certain thing. She can only do a certain amount of calls, and I don't like to be out somewhere with no phone.
After some conversation, Joan convinces April she can wait a day for a phone until she's had a chance to get the right paperwork from the Department of Public Assistance. By 11 a.m., April is exhausted. She sets aside her list of errands.
I'm overwhelmed right now. My stomach still feels kind of sick. I'm really, I thought that I could just do everything so fast, you know, and was like, oh, I could do this. Oh, yeah, I could go do that. I'd be fine. And all of a sudden, it just hit me, and I was like, oh, no, I'm done for the day. No more.
On her last stop before heading home, friends from a therapy program give her a gift pack of essentials, a bus pass, a book, a water bottle, and...
gum! Gum?
Yeah, you can have gum.
Gum! Man, you don't get gum. Yeah. I haven't had gum in 2.5 years. So guess what? I'm giving you a piece right now.
During her first week out, she spends time with family, rebuilding connections she hasn't had in years. She doesn't have a phone yet, so I keep in touch via Joan, who says April's in good spirits. 11 days after her release, Joan picks her up to run some errands before April's graduation ceremony from TLC at Highland that night.
We went to Nordstrom's and she got a few perfume samples, and she loves perfume. And then we went to visit her PO officer.
And that's where April's story takes a different turn. She's arrested for parole violations and sent back to Highland, where Joan visits her 2 days later. Joan says April told her she was on a prescription painkiller for her injured foot, but she forgot to bring in proof to show her parole officer. Joan says it was discouraging for both of them.
She plans to just depend on the Lord and try to stay close to Him and try to be patient and just wait and see what happens one day at a time.
Joan says she hopes April will use the time back in to make a better plan so that her next time out is more successful.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit. We're talking about prisoner reentry. That was the first story in a series by Ann Hillman, KSK reporter, who's here with me, and Morgan Jaco with the Department of Corrections. And, you know, at the beginning of the story, it really seems like she is turning her life around, but it doesn't. I mean, it's just 11 days and when April is back in prison. Morgan, how typical is her experience?
Unfortunately, it's very typical. You know, the idea of planning for your release sometimes seems not as important until you're actually out there. But the revolving door that she mentioned, that revolving door concept, is apparent in not only Alaska, but nationwide. The substance abuse issues right away when they get out, if that's not addressed while they're inside, then there's just all those needs when they get out. And it's immediate gratification sometimes when an individual is released. They're thinking of food, like Denny's. Those eggs sounded delicious. I'm sure she loved them that moment. And just those small things like the phone and the housing. She'd already given up the $100 for the housing. So there's just always the immediate needs that we all think about. And then the long-term planning seems to kind of just fall down when you get out.
But she was in TLC. She was in like a substance abuse program. She seemed to have kicked her habit. Does the planning that you do when you're still on the inside, does it just not always translate necessarily?
Exactly. Translation is a good way to put that. It doesn't, you can plan it all out on paper, but how it actually falls out when you're in person doing it live, that's kind of what I'm focusing on right now, is that transition from the inside to the out and how it doesn't fall through. And a lot of it is getting the community partners involved and everybody with that plan, with that reentrance, so we're all on the same page and supporting that person as they go through the process. So that hopefully that translation is actually more easy, accessible, and I mean, it's going to be hard. You know, no matter what, there will be road bumps, but we can overcome them together. You know, but it does take somebody really wanting to and a lot of effort, and it's hard.
And Anne, you really got to kind of embed with April on that first morning. What did you learn from that process?
I learned, you know, okay, so one of the things that she said, and she said a couple times over and over, was that she was pumped and really genuinely excited to be out there. And she was like, you know, people say I'm going to be exhausted by 11, but I'm not going to be exhausted by 11. And by 11 o'clock, pretty much on the dot, she was done. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, she had forgotten her ID back at the phone store, and we had to go back and get it. And she wanted to run by this program called Beauty for Ashes. And like, she was done by 11. And apparently that's pretty typical. Just she said, yeah, normally I'm up this early, 5:30, no problem. But by 11, I'm, you know, taking a nap. Mm. Is it pretty true?
And I also think like the adrenaline rush, you know, mm-hmm. you're out, you're excited, you're feeling like you can really do this and you can tackle it all, and then reality hits and it can be exhausting. And yeah, like you said, you were probably running around all morning. It's exhausting for anybody. So on top of that, put someone that just got released and used to a different environment, and there's all these other variables involved at that point that I'm sure she was exhausted. I'm exhausted for her.
Yeah, no, and just like talking about things like traffic, mm-hmm. you know, people all around. And I heard that from so many different reentrants that I spoke with. Like just that initial, here I am in this crowded environment, and nobody's telling me what to do, and there's all these people around, and I'm like...
And look at the tree, and there's wind, and, you know, if there was snow on the ground, then there's just so much going on. You know, it's probably a shock to her system and to everyone else's.
Yeah, it's reverse culture shock, like, in the truest sense.
And Morgan, give us the big picture here. I mean, in terms of planning for a prisoner's release, what does that big picture plan look like?
The big picture plan, I mean, currently the Department of Corrections is kind of we're revamping, taking a different look at it. We've always done reentry, but it's, you know, this new shift is a shift in ideology for we're looking at a more humane, like holistic view and really trying to pull in community partners and all the stakeholders. And right now we have coalitions going on in Anchorage. We have four around the state that are funded and four others that are up and coming. But so we're getting more people involved, and the big picture, you know, we're looking at internally and externally of everybody helping. So, you know, we have a three-phase process that we look at in the department, which focuses on, you know, an intake and assessment and then planning for the release and then the release. And I can get into that with more detail if you want me to at any point. But so there's different phases that we look at, and during one of the phases, the goal is for the community partners to start coming in and doing in-reach and really focusing on this plan that we're all working on together, which is the probation officers working on it, the education coordinators, the substance abuse providers, and everybody inside, but also those key people outside. And then most of all, most importantly, is the reentrant themselves. So everybody has a say. And, you know, really there's just a lot at stake there. So if everybody's on the same page and we're all working together and collaboratively, then hopefully that, you know, increases the chances of success.
And that in-reach portion, the, you know, going into the prison to help people before they come out, is that not happening now or just not happening to the same extent that you want it to happen?
Yeah, I mean, both. It's happening in small amounts, but not in a collective, you know, let's all pull in together and do this, you know, in a bigger process. So there's small bits and pieces here and there. But if we're all on the same page and working together towards it, then we're just hoping, you know, to do a shift on for everyone. We want each and every individual coming out to have a plan, and so no one falls through the cracks. You know, like the TLC program that April was in, there's people, you know, you plan specifically for your transition at that point, but there's people that aren't in those programs that don't have that.
And when I was at Highland, I spoke with, there's a social worker who's based at Highland. Is that, and she was getting people signed up for public assistance. She was helping people connect with their families, doing OCS cases, teaching people to crochet. You know, all of these different things. Is her role at Highland unique? Are there social workers everywhere? Can they do that much with that many people?
Yeah, it's unique, but that idea would be amazing in every facility. I would really love that. And I think that that's something that we're trying to bring. You know, maybe not specifically the social worker, maybe, but, you know, overall, just someone that is there that can do those the little things that count the most. You know, people need help with filling out the Social Security application or getting food stamps and applying for disability and all those little things that are huge in the end. But it's just sometimes hard to do without someone.
Okay, and we have a caller, Roger from White Mountain. Hi, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, good morning. Happy holidays.
Good morning.
President Obama proposed to move nonviolent prisoners out of American prisons. Does Alaska have a large nonviolent prison population? If so, how large? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Okay, and Morgan, is that something you can address?
You know, not fully, but there is a shift in our prisoner population now versus, say, a decade ago. There were more violent offenders in a decade ago. Now the majority of our population is for nonviolent offenses, and unfortunately they're serving longer prison terms as well. So it's part of this whole, you know, Pew Reinvestment, the Justice Project is looking at, you know, sentencing and the whole picture, because there are the majority of nonviolent offenders that are in our system.
Right. And you know, like you said, the state is working on that right now. And I think we have another Talk of Alaska planned for later this month on that whole other subject. So Roger, listen in later this month, and we'll get deeper into that. But right now, Morgan, can you talk about your new role with the Department of Corrections? Because it's a completely new job, right?
Somewhat. It's kind of morphing into what I've been working on reentry for a couple of years now with the department, since it's always been my passion, and I'm really happy to be on and hoping more people become passionate about this subject. But, you know, really I'm just working with the department in general and the outside sources in trying to make sure their transition plan is set and in motion. So, you know, it's comprehensive, and I, you know, right now I'm really working and focusing on working with the coalitions. And we have four around here, which is in Anchorage, Mat-Su, Fairbanks, and Juneau. And those coalitions right now, we're doing a big community assessment. We've got a meeting today about it, actually, and we're going to, the community assessment will look at the, really kind of look at all of the assets that we have in the community and look at the barriers. What are we missing to help with these reentrants, and focus on how we can get the other resources in the picture, so then we can really work with the reentrants.
And what are the biggest barriers that you see?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a ton. But, you know, the main things are housing. Like Anne said, she got involved in it because of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation vouchers, which we just got 20 in Anchorage. But 20 is huge. I don't want to downplay it. That's awesome. But think about the vast majority. And there's tons more that need help. So housing, employment is huge. Food and money. And, you know, the thing is that it's all intertwined. You can't really have one without the other. If you don't have, say, the job, then you really, how are you going to pay for the apartment? But if you don't have a car, how can you get to the job? And so it all goes hand in hand, and it just kind of sometimes snowballs, which is why right now one of my main parts of my job is really looking at the holistic view and how can we do it in a totality of, like, the circumstances of looking at the whole thing, because there's not just one slice of the picture that you can fix. Mm-hmm. You're putting a Band-Aid on a problem if you don't look at it fully.
So with housing, can we talk a little bit more about that? I've actually had a little bit of trouble getting people to talk to me about housing and people with criminal histories. Like, is that...
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of, like, the big apartment lenders up here. I don't know if that's the right word for them.
Apartment complex owners.
Yeah.
The renters.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of them have the federal bans of, you know, if you have a drug conviction or a sex offense, you know, a lot of it is the NIMBY, not in my backyard attitude. People don't want quote unquote, quote, criminals around. It's some sort of stigma that is really, you know, it's poisonous to our communities, because it can't be an us versus them if we're going to take them all back and this is our community. So, you know, housing is a huge issue. Part of what the Reentry Center does, and, you know, I met you on the reentry walk a month ago, but it's really about bringing awareness and talking to people, you know, one-on-one. Are you a landlord? Do you want to rent to someone? And it's kind of their personal, you know, personal experience that somebody has, and, you know, you have one successful one and then you can do two, and then they tell their friend who's a landlord. And so hopefully we're just trying to spread the word on that. And then, you know, at the same time, hopefully cut back some of those federal regulations that prevent housing for everyone, and housing vouchers and all that.
So. We're talking about prisoner reentry on Talk of Alaska. If you want to join the conversation, the call-in number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, dial 550-8422. And you can email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And another one of those barriers, of course, is work, finding work. And this is another piece that Anne got into with the series that I want to play. So, Anne, why don't you set this up?
So this piece is about a man named John and his wife, Shannon, and we are only using their first names. Before I did this piece, I actually met with John. We met for lunch, and he told me his whole story. And this man is put together, like, 1,000 times more than I am. And he laid it out. He's like, listen, I will share my story, but I don't want to give my whole name, because... And he had discussed this with his coworkers. He had discussed this with his boss. But the fact is he works with a lot of clients who don't know his history, and his immediate coworkers do. But he's like, yeah, that could really hurt my family. That could hurt my career because there's still such a stigma. And so he invited me over to his house, and I sat down with him and his wife, Shannon. And this is the conversation that we had.
I just knew that he was going to be my husband, and I just kind of knew.
But Virjon, that first day, you knew?
She knew.
After spending nearly 20 years behind bars, nothing was that straightforward.
You know, when I first got released, relationships were very hard for me. It was one thing to have relationships with my family. So it was really scary to have anything other than that. And so I wasn't prepared to be in a romantic relationship. I wasn't prepared emotionally or mentally to be in one. And yet here's this woman that I wanted to be in one with and didn't know how to do it.
John was 19 in early 1994 when he went to prison for his involvement with a murder. To put it in context, that was before the internet was big, before Kurt Cobain died, and before apartheid officially ended in South Africa. John says when he was finally released in 2013, he struggled with even simple things, like being alone in public spaces without someone of authority around. And he faced one of his biggest challenges— finding a job.
It was a nightmare. It was crazy. When I first got out, trying to find any job, Denny's wouldn't hire me. They wouldn't even look at me a second glance. I'm no fast food place, no restaurants. They didn't want to hire someone who had done as much time as I'd done, who had made the mistakes that I'd made. They didn't want to take the chance on me.
He says he applied to dozens of places, but no one would look past the check marks in the box indicating he had a criminal history.
You know, trying to put down murder in the first degree and perjury, you know, how's that look? I don't want someone that was in for murder working for me. I had so many people just shut the door. I had one place in a computer shop where I got into the interview. Interview went good. When we talked about my situation, he said, my insurance will never cover you. So I can't hire you.
It took John 2.5 months before he got his first break, and the job was temporary. He was let go from the next position because felons can't work in places that sell firearms.
There was at least one time there when I was ready to go back, ready to give up and go back. But I didn't because of this woman next to me.
Do you remember that point?
Yes, I do. It was pretty scary. Just the fact that, you know, he couldn't find any job, and it was just really scary to know that, you know, the stigma and the fact that, you know, what he did 20 years ago is still affecting his life now.
The stigma comes up in conversation over and over with almost everyone with a criminal background. Tamika Ledbetter, the manager of the Mat-Su and Eagle River Job Centers, says the stigma of returning from prison is real, but not every employer is opposed to hiring people with criminal histories.
Employers are more willing to take a chance on a returning citizen than most returning citizens are even aware of.
She says many small local businesses, construction companies, and seafood companies are willing to look past criminal records. And there are incentives. The federal government offers tax credits to companies that hire felons within 1 year of release. The state offers fidelity bonding, which is like free extra insurance in case an employee does steal from the employer. Ledbetter says people can get past the box by writing quality resumes that focused on their skills, just like any other applicant.
Skills are skills are skills, and they don't necessarily need to come from paid employment. So any volunteer work, any work that you've done on the side, whatever it is that you've done, we want to look at those skills. And even those things that you were doing when you were inside.
John's resume focuses on his computer skills, things he learned in classes and taught himself while he was still incarcerated. And he has a good job now, a really good job, that helps him pay his bills and support his family. But he's still worried about the stigma. He thinks that if everyone knows he has a murder charge, he could lose everything he's worked for. And that's why we're only using his first name.
You're sharing my background because I'm in a position that I work with clients all day. And I'm afraid that that if the clients that I work with knew my past, that it would adversely affect my position.
John explains that his higher-ups recommended he not share his full name because they had the same fear, that clients wouldn't want to work with him. But for Shannon, the danger of his past being publicly announced on the radio is about more than just his livelihood.
I don't want people to look at John as who he was versus who he is now. because he's a totally different person.
John nods in agreement. He's not a 19-year-old kid anymore trying desperately to be cool. He's a father, a church leader, and a professional computer technician. It took him years to get to this point, and he has no desire to go back.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations and communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and we're talking about prisoner reentry today. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. Do you work for an organization that helps prisoners transition to the community? Do you have an idea that might help with the process? Call 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Or email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And I'm here with Morgan Jaco, who's reentry coordinator for the Alaska Department of Corrections, and Ann Hillman, who is an urban affairs reporter for KSKA. She produced the series that we're airing this week on Alaska Public Media, and she's holding a community forum here Thursday at 7 p.m. Anything you want to add to that, Ann?
We are encouraging audience questions. We want this to be a conversation. If you can't come, but you'd like to submit questions, please do online at alaskapublic.org. This is a way to get people talking about something, and we need to have this conversation. It's important. This is our community.
Mm-hmm. And Morgan, you are a probation officer also in your job. And probation officers play a huge role in this process, both inside prison and out of prison. Describe what a typical day is like for a probation officer.
Oh, actually, can we go right really quick back to John's
sure.
story?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I just wanted to comment, you know, he is so inspirational, I think, to all reentrants and to me and to a lot of people that I work with. I think something good to point out about him and his story is that it's this perseverance and not giving up. And his positive attitude, it really makes a difference. When you meet him, you know, it's this glowing, he doesn't take a day out for granted. And I think that is key to like success. Just keep moving forward. There will be setbacks. I'm always blunt with my probationers or for the people that I'm working with. It's just, you know, things are going to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't try to coat this rainbow picture with it. But, you know, he has this attitude of continuing on and just persevering. And I love it. So I just wanted to make note of that.
And a lot of what he said was that he has something to lose.
Yes.
And that's huge. Mm-hmm. And he's not going to lose it. Like, he loves his baby. He loves his wife. He loves his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, yeah, I mean, I only spent a few hours with him, five, you know, and
yeah,
it's very obvious.
We're both glowing from just talking about him right now because he does. He makes me happy.
Yeah.
I love to see, I mean, that's why I keep working in this field. I love to hear these stories, to meet the people, to be part of them. And so anyways, back to your question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
So the day of a probation officer, you know, I've never been a field officer, so I have to, state that right off. I started out at the maximum security prison down in Spring Creek, down in Seward, called Spring Creek. But, you know, the day of an institutional probation officer, you work with the inmates, and you have different duties like classifying them and doing these assessments to where you are able to. We conduct an assessment called an LSIR, which is an evidence-based assessment tool.
What does that mean, LSIR?
It's level of service inventory revised. So, but you know, it's just an assessment tool that really looks at their risk and their needs. So you can identify, you know, what programs to refer them to while they're inside to really help them be a success when they do get out.
So like, what kind of questions does that include?
You know, it does a whole, it looks at your criminal history. It looks at your employment status before you went in and, you know, currently, and if you're working in the kitchen or what you're doing now. It looks at education. It looks at your family history, your substance abuse history, your, you know, mental health, housing. It kind of looks at everything so you can, you get a risk and a number associated with these different categories. And then it helps the probation officer inside refer you to different programs. So, you know, that's kind of the main job of an institution probation officer is to help assist the individuals in so they can be as most successful as possible when they get out. And the field probation officers pick that right up. I think it was stated earlier with April Wilson's story that you have to report within 24 hours of release to the probation officer if you're supervised, if you're on supervision. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that probation officer is checking in with the reentrant, looking at their needs, making sure that everybody's on the same page, reviewing their conditions to make sure that the individual completely understands everything. Because it's really hard to be compliant if you don't know what's expected of you. You know, so a lot of it is about open communication. And I always tell people that, you know, communicate, talk, let everybody know what, you know, if you're experiencing fears, anxiety, you know, put it all out on the table. A lot of people look at a probation officer from an adversarial type of point of view, but it should really be an alliance. It's a team. You know, we're here together, not only the reentrant and the probation officer, but the service providers and everybody. We're working collaboratively and together. So we should be, you know, viewed as a person that can help you. Of course, there are times where you have to be held accountable. We don't want to enable anybody's criminal behavior or thinking. And so, you know, there are times where you do have to, you know, lay down the law and get a little bit more strict. But really, if you look at it at the standpoint of helping someone, I think it makes the relationship go a lot easier.
And I spent a day at the parole office and with Denise McKenzie. And then I also spoke with Carrie Belden and Rebecca Brunger, who are in charge of probation. And they talked a lot about this culture shift within probation and parole and this culture shift moving towards, yes, you still have to be in law enforcement, but you're a social worker mm-hmm. and you're there to enable and to connect resources and to ease this process through so long as everyone's open to working through it.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I was talking earlier about the shift in ideology with the department. You know, it's going from one spectrum of, you know, law enforcement to the other spectrum of social work. And I mean, there's always going to be a little bit of both. And, you know, I think it's really important to really keep the DOC employees on board with the shift. You know, a lot of it is internal with the correctional officers and the staff that are inside. Just making sure that it's a humane way to treat people, to, you know, people, these are human beings we're dealing with. These are family members, brothers, sisters, you know, mothers. And so it's really a shift in looking at it as a human, as an individual, and each person is different. And, you know, so it goes from the institution all the way out to the outside. And those field officers that you were just discussing that are working with these people every day. And it is a shift. And it's a slow one, but it is progressing, and it's exciting to see it happen.
Okay, there are a few callers I want to get to. First, Stu is on the line from Muldoon. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. We have a returnee living in our condo association, and it's not easy. I was wondering, is there any way that the system could allow for the people who live around the returnees be given a contact for the parole officers so we can have a handle on these people? I mean, talk about people who don't care about their community and violating condo policies. I don't know how to even approach these people. And another question I had for the person making the documentary is, are you going to tell us what the people are in prison for when you tell us about their case stories? That would be very interesting. There's just so many issues, and now that marijuana has been legalized and people are having a problem distinguishing between spice, it just seems like there's so many temptations out there, especially in our neighborhood now. But anyhow, if you could address those questions, it would be very helpful, I think, to find a way to live in peace with the folks who have propensities and other people are trying to make money off of them. It's kind of sad. You got a big hill to jump over, I think.
Okay. Well, Anne, do you want to start?
Well, I mean, first off, I guess I kind of want to jump into these people type of comment. Like, everyone's an individual and everyone has individual struggles and individual personal barriers to go over. So while I understand that you might be having difficulties with an individual who's living in your community, I think it's really important that we all remember that you can't lump everyone together. Like, everyone who has left prison has a different story. With the different people that I've spoken with, yes, I have talked to, like, mentioned what they've been in for, because then sometimes that influences what conditions they have upon release. It influences what barriers are put up on them. So I think in all of the stories I've done, it has been mentioned. Yeah. Yes.
And both the stories we played, you did mention it. It mm-hmm. might have gone by pretty quickly, but mm-hmm. we do put that in the stories. Mm-hmm. And Morgan, do you have advice for someone who's, obviously everybody's experience is different, but I do understand, it could be a struggle.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of piggybacking off what Anne was saying with the individual, I would also ask if you've really just gone directly to that person and said, you know, hey, these are our condo rules. This is, you know, what we'd like to see out of people living here. Because if they are approached just as everyone else in that community, it might come off, you know, in a smoother way. And I'm not sure if that has been done or not yet. But if it has been done and there are serious issues that need to be, you know, looked into or resolved, I would just recommend calling the Anchorage Probation Office. And I'm not sure if you know the individual's name, but they can connect you to the specific PO, but really I would broach the subject with them as a community to community member and not single them out as a probationer living in the community. Because that really, you know, it's an awareness that can really help gauge how the response is going to be.
Because the thing is that the person just may not know.
Yes.
You know, like, sometimes you have to learn how to be a good neighbor. Mm-hmm. And that's not just for people reentering the community. That's in general. But sometimes people just genuinely don't know. And there's a whole program set up. Like, the Sean Lute is this program set up to teach you how to be part of a community. Because if you haven't grown up in a community, and this comes up over and over, if you haven't come up and grown up in a situation where, like, you know how to be a good roommate, how you know how to interact with other people in society, you're not going to. Like, that's a skill that's taught through your environment, and some people don't have an environment that teaches it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, when people are releasing, their skill sets are different, and sometimes it really is the basic how to cook a meal, how to pay your rent. You know, we have classes to show you how to pay your rent, to budget your money, to learn how to use a bank account. I mean, you know, really everybody's situation is so different. So I really agree with you. It's a learning
It's
level.
A learning curve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Stu. And we also have Phil on the line from Anchorage. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Excellent program. I'm concerned that there seems to be something missing, although I missed the first few minutes of the program. And that's, you know, the role of these privatized facilities, the halfway houses, for instance, the Cordova Center, in the mix here. I worked for the company that first started the Cordova Center, Allvest, from 1986 to 1993, working my way up to the program director of the Cordova Center, and then the executive assistant of the owner of the company, Bill Weimer, who eventually ended up being convicted of corrupting politicians. And I'm concerned about this privatized aspect and its ability to continue corrupting our process. That process's relationship to rehabilitation itself, most notably in not just our state, but others, in lobbying to have more nonviolent offenders incarcerated in their facilities for a steep price. And I'm wondering how that's being dealt with these days in our state in our reduced financial straits.
Is that something you can address, Morgan?
I can comment on a little. We have, here in Anchorage, we have technically five halfway house, community residential centers, Cordova Center, Parkview, Glenwood Center, and then we have two residential treatment ones, the Clitheroe and Aquila. But so, yes, they are private, They have contracts with the DOC. You know, most is a GeoCare, which is one of the biggest privatized prison companies in the nation. We are, you know, they are part of this shift. They are part of, because they are part of the DOC. I mean, it's a private aspect of it, but they're part of this shift in treating people better. We're getting more reentry programming inside of the community residential centers to help with the people that can't get out, you know, because we have different people that are different individuals that are there on different statuses, whether it's restitution placement, a probation placement. We have people on furlough there, which is a transition from, you know, a halfway house out into the community. So we have people that are currently incarcerated at these community residential centers that are getting a job, trying to save up money so they can have housing when they get out and start their support network. They're going to AA meetings and stuff like that. So this, you know, they're not perfect. I'm not going to sit here and say that. I mean, obviously, the department's not perfect. None of us are. We're really working through some of these kinks and trying to make this a more positive, you know, as much as prison can be a positive experience. I know that sounds ridiculous, but
transformative.
Yes. You know, so when you're looking at that atmosphere, the CRCs, you know, we're trying to make them more effective, healthier, and a different type of environment than what people would normally think of.
And Phil, what do you think about that? Do you think private entities can play a role if they have the right sort of mindset?
I, you know, from the examples I've seen, I don't think we can trust them under any circumstances, and especially when we have Republicans in control of our legislative process. I've watched each individual case as they've been generated over the years in terms of pressures to legislate for, again, increased incarceration of nonviolent offenders, again, and not just in our state, but in others. I'd like to see some sort of a task force appointed by the legislature to look into the continuing corrupting aspects of privatized corrections in halfway houses and other aspects of correction.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call, Phil. And we need to take another quick break here, but we'll talk more about prisoner reentry as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Annie Feit, and today we're talking about prisoner reentry with Morgan Jaco with the Department of Corrections and Ann Hillman, urban affairs reporter here, who is working on a series that we're airing all this week on this issue. And Ann, you talked to a lot of people for the series.
So many people.
And we're gonna air a clip of an interview with one of those one of those people. Why don't you tell us who this is?
So her name is Stacey Davis, and she talk about a person who's a ray of light. She was only actually in jail for 3 months, and it was because of addiction related issues. And she's now in transitional housing. She's at a place called the Damascus House. And in this clip of the interview, she talked a little bit about what it's like to live there. And let's listen to it, and then I can describe the room a little bit to you as well.
And even being here, this has made a huge difference, having a safe place to live. I mean, I know where I live. I live pretty much in the heart of a lot of issues. But the fact is I have a safe room, you know. I could walk around and I could choose at any point in time to fall back into my old habits. But so many good things have started to happen in my life that it has caused me to actually take a moment to stop and think, like, this is what I would lose. And it's become so great that I don't want to lose it anymore. So
when you first got here, I mean, that's a really interesting point. We're right kind of in Spinard, Midtown. Was it tempting at first?
Well, you know, at first, okay, so I was in jail, and I was only in jail for 3 months. There are people that have been in jail for years and years. And so, you know, there's this element of, oh my gosh, I can do whatever I want now, you know, which is very exciting. And so when I first got out of jail, I walked to the store, you know, while I was waiting for my mom to pick me up because I was so excited to be out. But then I found myself also very scared to be by myself because I knew how quickly and easy it would be for me to fall back into old ways. And you know, there was a part of excitement in the freedom, but also the realization of how that freedom could be very detrimental. But you know, the really awesome thing is I have such a heart for other people like me. You know, I have a huge heart for addicts. I have a huge heart for people who don't know that there's a way out of their situation. So I also, now that I have some time under my belt, really love being where I'm at because I love being around people that are either just like how I was or who are just like how I am now or who are even further along. I don't ever want to be away from this because of the fact that it has impacted my life so much and because I felt like for a long time that my life was a waste. So for me to not feel that way anymore, I just want to give that back to other people. So it is to a degree very much in my face where, you know, the area of town that I live and I could at any point in time choose to fall back into that if I wanted to. But at the same token, there's a beauty in knowing that and in being around people just like that and in wanting to be able to kind of help show like that, you know, there is a way out.
So tell me about this room that we're in right now.
I live in a little room that doesn't have much, but I love it. I feel so proud of it. I was homeless for over 3 years, meaning I did not have my own home. So that meant I lived in either hotels. I lived in a tent for a period of time. I lived in vehicles. Now I have a job. I pay rent here and I consider this my home. And even though it's not luxurious or by any stretch, but I'm so proud of it because it's mine. And, you know, I don't, one of the things that has been, you know, actually, I feel like an awesome thing that I've taken out of being homeless is that I have lived where I didn't have anything. And I also have lived a life where I had, you know, you could consider everything. I used to have a very nice vehicle, had a very nice home. I had lots of nice things. So to have had both sides of that, you know, it really can make you appreciate the things that you do have. I can't say it enough. I love where I live. I absolutely love it. I love the fact that I get to be around people all the time who really appreciate what they have. There is a real beauty in being around a bunch of people that don't have much because they value so much the things that they have and they value so much the things that are given to them. It's really actually an amazing experience.
Okay, so that's Stacy. And Anne, why don't you talk a little bit more about her and her living arrangement?
So her room is a bunk bed and a dresser and a folding chair and a mini TV pretty much for her and two people. Like it's a little teeny tiny smaller than a dorm room kind of room. And she loves it. Like she's got photos of family and friends on the wall. She's got a map of Mars on the wall because she's really interested in space. You know, to me, she came across as a person who, she learned a lesson. Like, she was in jail for a little bit of time, and she was like, all right, gotta fix that. Got out, got a job as soon as she could, got housing. It's transitional housing, but it's what she needed to be stable, and she got it really quickly. And it's kind of this example of, all right, if you have a positive support network in place through church or through AA, or through family, if you've got these basic nuggets, you can move forward.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what's so key about a lot of the transitional living environments around here is that it's, you know, definitely not somebody's own place right now, but it's their own space and it's their own room. And it's something, like she was saying, something to be proud of and, you know, a little bit at a time. And so it slowly builds this foundation and it you hear people excited. And yes, it could be just a really small room, but hey, it's theirs. They can close the door. They can leave whenever they want to. And so there's a lot of transitional living places right now that are really important for reentry.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the social situation that prisoners face when they exit prison. Mm-hmm. What struggles are
you there? Know, it's funny because this is the when I was at Success Inside and Out with Anne at Highland Mountain, and it was actually one of the first times that it really hit me how important peer-to-peer support was and actually just sober activities, because that is huge. And that was one of the biggest concerns that I heard all day. What am I going to do instead of going to the bar, instead of this, instead of that? Because it was always associated with partying or drinking or doing some sort of drug. So that's something that I'm still struggling and trying to help, you know, with the community members figure out some sober ideas and figure out more activities to do as a reentrant and, you know, fun things. You don't have to just stay inside and shut the door.
I mean, one of the things they were talking about during Inside Out was running. Like, people have started, there's a program where, a running program inside Highland, and Skinny Raven donates shoes, and, you know, people get into running, and that's such a great release. Or, you know, for biking for other people, or just being outdoors. And so it's not even just talking to people who have struggled with addiction and have been in prison, but so many of the other individuals I've spoken with for stories over the past couple of years, it's about finding not just other activities to do, which is necessary, and sometimes that's getting immersed in culture, and sometimes it's really learning to read or watch movies. But it's also, you have to shift your peer group. And that is so often an issue. Like, you have to find other people to hang out with, which is hard. Like, you have to change your friend group. I mean, can any of you guys imagine that?
Yeah. Well, and it's this catch-22, because at the same time, when you're inside and you're building these networks and you're in AA and you have this support group there, you want it on the outside, but then by your probation conditions, you can't associate with felons. So it's this problem that continues to arise. And, you know, I don't think we have any quick short-term solutions for it, but
no. Yeah, I was talking to one guy who is on who's on parole, and he's like, this is ridiculous. I work with other people who are felons, and we can hang out and be friends at work, but that clock ends and you better walk that way and I walk that way, otherwise your parole officer's gonna get you. He's like, someone else is like, how do I know if someone's a felon? Which is a very good point. You can't very well just be like, what's your criminal history? I got to check before we're friends. Mm-hmm. So it's, socializing is a challenge.
Very big challenge.
And we just have about a minute left. What's kind of your takeaway, Morgan? What are the biggest things that you feel like you really want people to know about this process, or want
Boy, to that's a big question.
Work on? Yeah.
I would just say that this is everyone's problem. You know, this is a community issue, like Anne was saying. So I'm glad to be here so we can make more, you know, everybody aware of this, get people on board. And, you know, it's not just something that Department of Corrections can fix. Like, this is a community issue that we all need to focus on. We all need to get involved, and we all need to care like we do. But yeah, it's, you know, this is just not something that happens to somebody else. This is everyone's problem.
And Anne, how about you?
I want to echo what Morgan says. The fact is that we, all of us in Alaska, interact with people who have criminal histories, and we just don't know it. And it's just like all the other issues that plague our community, is their solutions. And are they easy? No, not easy solutions. But if we start looking at the issue differently, maybe we can make a difference. I realize that's all warm and fuzzy, but... There you have it.
Okay, that's a great spot to end. Thanks to my guests, Morgan Jaco and Anne Hillman. You're listening to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
On Thursday, December 3rd, Alaska Pacific University is hosting an open house from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. in the Carr Gottstein Lobby. Learn about environmental science, outdoor and environmental education, and K-8 teaching certification programs. To find out where these APU programs can take you, hashtag ThisIsOurClassroom. This message sponsored by APU.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.